United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Judge Toth and Judge Falvey. We're convened today via teleconference to hear argument in the matter of David A. Andrews versus Robert L. Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 19-352. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please make your appearance?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is James Ridgway, and with Tom Palsano, we are of Bergman & Moore, and we represent Mr. David A. Andrews in this
matter. Thank you, Mr. Ridgway. Secretary's counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Alexander Yu, and along with Joan Moriarty, we represent the Secretary in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Yu. Mr. Ridgway, do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
We'll make that happen, and you can begin whenever you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Once again, my name is James Ridgway, and I represent the veteran Mr. David Andrews in this case, who is watching this argument live from home. This is a case about the rule of law. For over a decade, Mr. Andrews has been fighting to have his claim for service connection for hepatitis C granted. VA's own adjudication manual tells frontline staff to apply the benefit of the doubt, quote, in favor of the veteran when the evidence favoring risk factors in service is equal to the evidence favoring risk factors before or after service. This is a rule of general applicability from the top of VA that governs the outcome of this case. All of the evidence supports findings of risk factors in service. None of the evidence supports a finding of any risk factor outside of service. And at this point, the court should have a definite and firm conviction that it is time to grant the claim. A remand, as the secretary asks for, would only be to fish for additional negative evidence that has so far not been produced through the two VA examinations that have already been obtained.
Mr. Ridgway, let me... Let's pick up with the M21, because it strikes me the M21 here to kind of does two different things, right? On the one hand, it lists specific risk factors, right? And my understanding reading Overton is, you know, the board would have a duty to discuss those risk factors, right? So that's one thing. The second is what you've mentioned. It seems to provide almost a meta framework for how to adjudicate these cases. Right. And the way you described it is it basically the veteran has to list some risk factors, and then VA would have to kind of, I guess, balance countervailing risk factors and award accordingly. Right. Under Overton, does the board have a duty to follow that framework?
So Overton presents a different situation. And that line of cases is fundamentally different than the situation.
Okay, so if not Overton, right? I mean, or at least like we can use Overton for this much, right? Which is, it's a tacit recognition that the M21 is non-binding on the board, right? So my question is if the framework itself is non-binding, right? Then the board would be able to use maybe some alternative framework to adjudicate, right? I mean, it could choose the most probative evidence, or it could do anything. It could do a balancing, the plaintiff meets their burden and then it shifts. You know, there's just a lot, totality of factors, and there's a lot of ways to adjudicate a case. So the point is, my question is, on what basis would the framework itself that the M21 suggests be binding on the board?
Fundamentally, I think we have to step back and understand what the M21 is, and then we can see that in cases where the veteran seeks the benefit of a favorable rule, they have the right to invoke the rule of law and say that this must be applied to my case unless the agency articulates a reason why my case falls outside the intended scope of that rule.
Sure, and again, sorry to kind of... So I understand like the risk factors, right? I mean, the acknowledgement of expressed risk factors, I mean, that's favorable to the to the veteran. But how is the how is this framework, say, favorable as opposed to like a totality of circumstances framework? I mean, how is, I don't see how it's, I mean, you could say, you know, you could argue it creates a presumption, but that again strikes me more as to like the list of explicit risk factors than it does the framework itself.
So this M21 provision, unlike many others, is phrased very specifically. It tells adjudicators that if the evidence of in-service risk factors is at least equal to the evidence of non-service risk factors, then the outcome is to apply the benefit of the doubt. This is a proscriptive command. And so I think it's good to start at the beginning. The M21 is the command authority from the Director of Compensation, who reports to the Undersecretary of Benefits, whose delegated authority to run the system. And when we look at the authority of the Director of Compensation through the VA's functional organizational manual. So VA has a 460-page org chart that is publicly available on the internet, and it shows you that the Director of Compensation reports to the Principal Deputy Undersecretary, and then when you read the functions and authorities of the Director of Compensation, it is to run the way that the adjudication process is adjudicated. And it explicitly says that this is the person who makes changes to how the system operates through the M21. This is an agency process, and agencies respond to Congress, stakeholders, this OMB, and agency leaders. When they're made aware of a situation that needs a consistent answer, they issue orders to the field to do things in a certain way.
In this, could I just ask one question on that point before you move on? But you are not suggesting that the Director of Compensation can bind the board, are you?
I'm suggesting that the Director of Compensation can bind the agency and state what the agency's official position is. This is different than a regulation.
No, let me just stop you, because it's a technical point, and I'm not sure you need to stake out this hill to prevail, but it is your position that when the Director of Compensation implements something in the M21, he or she actually binds the full agency as if the secretary, him or herself, had done it, including the board?
So it does not bind the agency in the same way that a regulation or statute would, but in order to depart from the rule announced, the board has to articulate reasons or bases why this case falls outside of the scope of the intended purpose. Otherwise, we get to a situation which the Supreme Court has said in Morton v. Ruiz can't possibly be the case, where a rule can arbitrarily not be applied to an individual for no apparent reason.
Right, and to go back to Judge Toth's questions, right, that's the first of his articulations, I think. In other words, that's fundamentally the spirit behind Overton, right, which is the VA can use the M21 to set out what it does. It doesn't have to bind the board, but if the board is going to do something different than what the M21 says, it's got to articulate a reason for doing that. Or the flip side, if it follows what the M21 says, since it's not binding, it's got to do more than cite it. It's got to explain why it's doing that, right? Is that fundamentally what you're saying?
Yes. So there's two lines. There's the line under Morton v. Ruiz, going back to Yick Wo and John Adams saying, we are a government of laws, not of men, that says that the application of the law cannot be at the ad hoc and dispensing funds. If the law says, if X, then Y, and a citizen can see that, a citizen's entitled to have that law applied unless the agency can articulate why this particular case falls outside of the intended scope. There's a separate line of cases under the Administrative Procedure Act, rather than due process and the rule of law, that says when an informal agency guidance is used against a person, they can invoke the APA and say, this hasn't been through proper notice and comment rulemaking, or this lacks a rational basis to support it. And so the APA gives people tools to use against something that's applied unfavorably. But that's distinct from the fundamental rule of law that says when the law says X, then Y, a citizen is entitled to have that law applied to it. And so I think the distinction is that when we look at the M21, we are less textualist than we would be with a regulation. So with a regulation or a statute, if the text says X and it admits no other interpretation, that's it. The analysis ends there. The M21, which has not gone through notice and comment, it hasn't received the full spectrum of stakeholders. I believe the board has the authority to go beyond the text and say, even though the text is clear, we can see from the larger picture that this rule was intended to govern this class of people, and this person doesn't fall within this class. And so I think the board has greater freedom to go beyond the text because it has not been subject to notice and comment or any other process that would refine the text. It's not issued by attorneys to speak to attorneys. It's by a non-attorney leader at the VA whose purpose is to tell the field, this is how you decide cases. If this is what you find, this is what you do. Like, this is not nefarious. We want the agency leadership to bring consistency. And then we want the veterans to be able to say, invoke the rule of law and say, you said this is the rule. All I want is either the application of that rule or some reason why that rule doesn't apply in my case. And when we read Morton v. Ruiz, what it says about the applicability of general rules is that they cannot be arbitrarily not applied by the dispenser of funds. Going back to the classic Yickwo v. Hopkins, we have the person who has the building made of stone or brick and wants to open a laundry, and the city is denying him that permit, not for any reason in that law, but just because he happens to be Chinese, which is not a valid reason. And Yickwo is not a case about discrimination. It's about the rule of law, and you have to follow the rules that you've articulated if they're clear. And so in this case, this is a rule that, as the Federal Circuit has described, is a rule that limits staff discretion and as a practical matter impacts eligibility for an entire class of veterans. We want VA leadership to make those rules. We want them to say, we need to do this consistently, here's the rule, and then say, okay, it must be followed when a citizen says, all I want is application of the rule. And so I think that this is what we're
asking. Let me ask you this, which is, I mean, qualitatively, how is the rule different from just the regular burden of proof in Gilbert, right? Which is, Gilbert, the veteran needs show that the current condition is at least as likely as not related to service, right? And presumably, veteran lists a bunch of risk factors, puts on some evidence that it's credible and competent, lay evidence included. VA doesn't put out any countervailing evidence. I mean, how would that not be functionally the same thing, get you to the same place?
I mean, I don't think it's any functionally different. I mean, this is just an articulation of how the benefit of the doubt works in a specific circumstance. And I think it's very helpful. And the reason why the director of compensation may have done it is I believe that there's a people in these hepatitis cases to fall prey to something that I've heard called Hoyle's fallacy, which is human beings have a tendency to think that low probability events functionally never occur. But they do occur. So if you take something that has a 1 or 2% chance of transmitting hepatitis, but you repeat that 10 million times for service members, what you're going to expect is that hundreds of thousands of them get unlucky. And they do end up getting hepatitis. And so we see exactly what we see, which is the prevalence of hepatitis in the veteran population, particularly of this era, is vastly higher than it is in the normal civilian population. Mr. Andrews submitted significant evidence on this point that we outlined in our brief. But you don't need to read that yourself. I'm just arguing that it is understandable why the director of compensation would have issued this rule. And so, I mean, I think at this point, it's a good moment to turn to the court's question that it asked for an argument, which is whether the presence of a single risk factor for hepatitis without more and in the absence of countervailing evidence is sufficient competent medical evidence to establish a nexus between hepatitis and SIRS? The answer to that question is emphatically yes. I have one quibble with it first, and that is it's phrased in terms of sufficient competent medical evidence. You do not need medical evidence to grant a hepatitis claim. The medical knowledge has been incorporated into the process by the director of compensation through the M21 provision that says these are the medically recognized risk factors for hepatitis. And we can see that many of them are observable by a layperson. And so you don't need medical evidence in order to prove a risk factor. You just need competent evidence, such as observing a jet gun injection, observing exposure to blood, observing sexual activity in service, observing that you got a tattoo in service. Most of these can be observed by a layperson, and you don't actually need a medical opinion. And it makes sense. You could look at this and say, well, wouldn't that rule lead to lots of claims being granted based on just one risk factor? And if we take it that 5 or 10 times more veterans have hepatitis C than the civilian population, well, it shouldn't surprise us at all that we would have a lot of claims for hepatitis C being granted, where we have these evidence of risk factors in service and no evidence of a risk factor outside of service. So this is just to say, this is not an absurd result. This is a result that is just completely consistent with what the statistics tell us about the prevalence of hepatitis. And so you can see that why the director of compensation would make this rule. Again, we're not asking the court to make this rule. We're just saying the director of compensation has made this rule. It's a rule of general applicability, and the court has the authority. The role of the court in judicial review is to enforce VA's own rule if it cannot give reasons or bases why this case doesn't fall within the scope of that rule.
So, Mr. Ridgway, so there's a case called the Diamond. It's a 1999 case. And I'm not going to put you on the spot whether you've seen the case or not. But basically, you know, the rationale is it was about asbestos exposure on a ship. And the M21 at the time recognized that as a risk factor, so not exactly like this, but similarly. And the court held that that basically because the M21 does not create substantive enforceable rights, it cannot create a presumption. I mean, more or less, that's what it said. I mean, so can you speak to that point that in the absence of an ability of a manual to create against substantive enforceable rights, there simply can't be anything that we would deem a presumption? Like you can't kind of start on first base, right, just by putting evidence downright. So what would you say about that?
I believe that is the argument that the Federal Circuit explicitly rejected in Hudick. The DOJ argued in Hudick that because the M21 is quote unquote not binding or not enforceable, it can simply be ignored. And the Federal Circuit said, no, that is not the rule. It expressly rejected the argument that you can just ignore it and instead said, no, it's binding. They cited the Honda Motors case and actually did cite Morton v. Ruiz too. And so there's this confusion here that because it does not have the force of law, that because a veteran can come in and invoke the Administrative Procedure Act and say, this can't bind me because you didn't publish it in the Federal Register, that also applies to the reverse situation where the veteran is trying to enforce the rule of law. Essentially, using it to deny the veteran the rule of law flips the Administrative Procedure Act on its head. It allows the government to use it as a shield that says, we don't care what instructions we've given to the field. You can't quote them back to us in court because we can freely ignore them. Like that is what the DOJ argued in Hudick. That is what the Federal Circuit expressly rejected in Hudick. And that is exactly what we would get from applying Morton v. Ruiz and Honda and the other cases cited in Hudick, that the rule of law applies where there's a rule of general applicability that is a command from the top of the agency and reflects the considered position of the agency, that field, I as the person who controls you, tells you to decide these cases this way, therefore you need to decide them this way. That is what it means to have a government of laws and not a...
Mr. Ridgway, I was going to ask you about Hudick, but so Hudick was non-precedential from the Federal Circuit, right?
Yes.
And, but my reading of Hudig is a little different than you've just articulated it. And I think it, I want to float an idea to just get your take on it. And I'll ask Mr. Yu the same question, which is, there is a potential to say that Hudig can resolve this, the logic of Hudig, even though it's not binding on us, the logic of Hudig could allow a resolution to this case on a much narrower ground than we've been discussing. Because if I recall, I might get the month wrong, but I think it was November 2017, but there was a prior board remand in this case, 2017, you're aware of it.
Yes.
And I think that that board remand specifically cited to the M21 provision we're talking about. It didn't discuss the benefit of the doubt rule, but it discussed the what I call the grid of risk factors, and it remanded for the RO to adjudicate. My reading of Hudig is what the Federal Circuit said in that case was, hey, board, we're not going to get into this whether you're bound by something or not, but you can bind yourself. That's Morton versus Rees and that line of cases. And you bound yourself in this case to comply with, in that case, it was a different provision, obviously, in Hudig. Why wouldn't that be a narrow way to do this? In other words, we wouldn't have to say that everybody in the world gets this benefit, but we're going to say, listen, Mr. And you've got time, so we'll let you answer my question. Dawn, could we put an extra 5 minutes on the clock, please? Why couldn't we resolve this matter in that way, that the board bound itself in Mr. Andrews' case to comply with the grid approach?
There's several different ways to address that. The first is that I do believe it is a logical, rational approach, but I don't think that it has to be the way that the court goes. It's not the argument that Mr. Andrews is making. It's not the defense that the secretary is raising. And when we look at what Hudig said, particularly when we look at the argument that the DOJ made in Hudig that was rejected, we can see that the governing principle is that the rule of law applies. And I think that when we look at yesterday's decision in Nova, which obviously we're all just digesting because it's only been out for a day. But it makes clear that when the agency through the M21 issues a rule that limits staff discretion and as a practical matter impacts eligibility for an entire class of veterans, that's a rule of general applicability. That can't be ignored. And so I think that is really the principle that applies. And ultimately, I mean, veterans should not have to rely on the grace of the board to say, you know what, this time I'm going to choose to apply the M21. That is exactly the arbitrary.
Are you expressly waiving the articulation of the argument that I just made on Hudig?
No, we would not expressly waive it. That would provide at least the pathway to the second question, which is reversal the remedy that's appropriate in this case? I will not waive that express. Given that I do have a few minutes, I do want to talk about why reversal is the appropriate remedy in this case, unless there's more questions about why the rule of law applies to the M21. And reversal is the appropriate remedy here because the board erred in finding that the preponderance of the evidence of record is against a finding that the veteran's current hepatitis is causally related to service. So all of the evidence shows risk factors in service, and there's no evidence that indicates non-service risk factors. So there's evidence of jet gun injections, and I can go through that. There's evidence of sexual activity in his service treatment records. And the M21 explicitly notes that this is a type of evidence that tends to prove the risk factor of high-risk sexual activity. There's the allegation of his exposure to blood. He alleges unsanitary dental practices and submits evidence asking the adjudicator to make the inference that there was a transmission through infected blood here. But there's also his denial of non-service risk factors. And I think the one thing that I really wanted to emphasize that in this case, there are two VA medical examinations that did not find non-service risk factors. facts. So the secretary argues in his brief on page 17 that the court should consider Monzingo and recognize that an inadequate medical opinion is entitled to some probative value based upon the information and analysis it contains. And we would actually agree with that. So over the past decade, Mr. Andrews has twice been subjected to medical examinations where his medical history was solicited and the examiners went through his records, and neither one of those turned up any evidence of a non-service risk factor. And when we look at the M21 itself under H2F, what we have, the development order of the M21 says development is necessary to determine if pre- and post-service risk factors are present and to identify risk factors based upon substance abuse. So the M21 says the purpose of the exam is to identify risk factors. They've had two opportunities to identify risk factors, and there's no specific reason to this case why there should be a third bite at the apple to fish for negative evidence. We've already had two medical experts look through this record and ask the veteran questions, and neither one identified a non-service risk factor. The secretary asked for a remand, but doesn't identify how medical knowledge would be applied to the specific facts of this case. We had one opinion that says, I disagree with the director of compensation's choice to recognize jet guns as a factor, but that's not a valid approach. And we had another medical opinion that wasn't actually medical that said, I find no corroboration in the records for Mr. Andrews' report of his exposure to unsanitary dental practices. But that's not a medical opinion. That's just a Buchanan violation that's being offered up to the board to put their name on it. There has to be a medical reason why there's something about this case that medical expertise could be applied to in order to justify a remand. In the absence of this, Adams applies. Mr. Andrews, and I see that I'm out of time, and I'll wrap up unless there's further questions on this point.
Judge Toth, do you have any other questions?
Not right now.
Good.
So thank you, Your Honors. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I take Judge Falvey's shake of the head to be that he does not have further questions.
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ridgway. We'll see you on rebuttal. Mr. Yu, you can begin when you'd like. You're muted.
Good morning. May it please the court. In this case, the court should remand the appellant's claim for hepatitis C for a new VA medical opinion and remand the appellant's claim for liver disease as secondary to hepatitis C. My presentation will consist of 3 points. First, I will address the court's question and explain why a single risk factor is insufficient evidence of nexus to establish service connection for hepatitis. Second, I will explain why remand is warranted in this case because the September 2017 VA examiner's opinion on which the board relied to deny service connection is inadequate for rating purposes. And then finally, I will explain why remand and not reversal is the proper remedy in this case. Turning to my first point, in response to the court's question, no, the presence of a single risk factor for hepatitis without more and even in the absence of countervailing evidence is insufficient competent medical evidence to establish nexus between hepatitis and service. There are 3 elements to service connection: a current disability, in-service event, injury, or disease, and then competent evidence that links the two, or nexus evidence. Appellant has the burden of establishing all 3 elements, which are distinct, before service connection is warranted. So in this case, appellant had the burden of establishing that it is at least as likely as not that his hepatitis is related to service. There is no presumption of service connection for hepatitis that would waive the need for competent medical evidence of nexus. And the M21 does not create such a presumption. When the M21 is read as a whole, it makes clear that a medical opinion is needed to determine whether or not the veteran's hepatitis is related to any in-service risk factors that have been identified. If we look to section H2E.
Let me ask you this. So, I mean, this is kind of a low evidence case, right? In that there's not much, you know, we don't have that much insight in really into what what the nexus or but my understanding is a really low number still beats zero, right? And is there anything that VA can cite to support its claim that that his hepatitis was not related to service?
Yes, Your Honor. First, we would disagree that there is no or little evidence here against nexus. First, the November 2010 VA examiner opined that appellant's hepatitis C is less likely not due to service, specifically exposure to jet gun injectors. But the examiner also opined that the most likely cause of appellant's hepatitis C is unknown in recognition of the three identified risk factors. Furthermore, the September 2017 VA examiner opined that appellant's hepatitis C is less likely than not incurred in service or is due to any in-service event, injury, or disease to include the three identified risk factors. So in this case,
Mr. Yu,
yes.
How does unknown get you there? I mean, if you've got risk factors, again, I think Judge Toth correctly describes them as, you know, the evidence of the risk factors is not that great, but if you're throwing those risk factors on the scales and you're putting nothing on the other side, even, you know, unknown has no weight, right? So how does that get you there?
In response to your question, Your Honor, we would emphasize that appellant has the burden of demonstrating that his hepatitis is at least as likely as not due to service. Now, the M21 recognizes that different risk factors carry with them varying degrees of likelihood of resulting in transmission of hepatitis C. Even though the examiner has identified that the most likely cause of appellant's hepatitis C is unknown, it is the appellant's burden to demonstrate that it's at least as likely as not.
So is it that I'm wrong conceptually about this when I think about scales and they put something on the scales and we've got to find something else on the other side or they win? Is it more that it's more like a beaker, you know, from science where they've got to fill it to the 50 milliliter line? And if they don't get there, it doesn't matter how many risk factors they list, they still got to get to that 50 milliliter line before they have met their burden. Or in other words, you don't begin with the scales in equipoise. You begin with an empty beaker, and they've got to fill it.
Yes, Your Honor. We would equate this appellant's burden more to the beaker scenario you just presented. The board would be permitted to deny service connection if appellant had presented insufficient, competent, credible, and probative evidence of nexus. Now, that's not the case here because, as I pointed out, the November 2010 and September 2017.
To you before you move from, because this follows up on both what Judge Toth said and Judge Falvey, just assume for purposes of answering my question now, because I know you don't agree with this, right? And I'm not sure I agree with what I'm going to say, just so you know. But just right now, just assume this. The M21 has this grid, as I call it, that lists, what is it, 7 risk factors, okay? Just assume with me that what the M21 has done is convert the beaker, to use Judge Falvey's metaphor, convert the beaker to the scale, okay? Meaning it says to adjudicators, we're going to help you out. Here is a grid, put a check mark next to each of these risk factors, then figure out, did that risk factor occur during service or before or after? Okay. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
If that were the approach, is there any evidence in the record that would allow an adjudicator to check one of those boxes for a pre-service or post-service risk factor?
No, Your Honor. There are no non-service related risk factors identified.
So then if, and again, I'm not saying this is what the answer is, right? If one were to read the M21 as adopting the approach that I just articulated, a scale approach, And if we say it was binding on the board under some logic in this case, right, then there is something on the in-service side of the scale and nothing on the pre or post-service side, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But to expand on this issue, we would disagree that the identification of in-service risk factors alone would be sufficient to establish nexus. And we disagree that the M21 actually directs this outcome. So section H2E of the manual, which is the provision identifying the appellant's opening brief, is only addressing the requisite evidence to establish the in-service event requirement. So in that situation, we would agree with the scale approach only as the in-service event requirement, and that if the evidence is equal as to an in-service risk factor, as opposed to non-service related risk factors, then the in-service event requirement has been satisfied.
This I thought that the note was it. I thought it used the phrase grant service connection. Is that what it says?
No, Your Honor. It says that a reasonable doubt should be resolved in appellant's favor if the evidence of in-service risk factors is equal to non-service related risk factors.
And so then basically what the dispute would be about this point would be, does that mean resolve reasonable doubt? Your version would be resolve reasonable doubt as to the second element of service connection, blah, 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 blah. And appellant's position, I'm not asking you to say what appellant's position is, but appellant's position would be resolve reasonable doubt as to the whole kahuna, so to speak, the whole thing of service connection. That's where you're differing on what the note says.
Correct, Your Honor. And we would emphasize that, as opposing counsel has already noted, that the M21 is written by non-attorneys for non-attorneys. So even if the use of the language resolve reasonable doubt is something that would appear in under the benefit of the doubt, here, the inartful use of the language in M21 does not demonstrate that service connection should be granted if there is an in-service risk factor. Rather, if you look into the remainder of the M21, it makes clear that a medical opinion is needed to determine whether or not the nexus element has been satisfied. First, if we look at the section H2E again, there are varying degrees of likelihood for different risk factors, and therefore a medical opinion is needed to determine whether or not these different risk factors rise to the level of being at least as likely as not the cause of the veteran's hepatitis. Furthermore, if you look at section H2J of the manual, it provides instructions for VA adjudicators as to what information needs to be provided when obtaining a VA medical opinion. Further, we would note that lay evidence is not competent to establish service connection by providing an etiology opinion as to appellant's hepatitis, or to provide an opinion as to whether or not the veteran's hepatitis is at least as likely as not due to any of the identified risk factors. Hepatitis is caused by a virus in the blood, and to determine whether or not the etiology of the hepatitis requires medical expertise and training in this case, in all cases. And because hepatitis is caused by a virus in the blood, which is too small for lay observation, we would contend and agree that a medical, competent medical evidence here is required before nexus can be established. If there are no other questions on this issue, I will move to my second point. Judge Toth, do you have a question?
Judge Toth, you're muted.
No, I'll get you started on your second point. What additional evidence is needed here?
The reason why remand is warranted in this case, because the September 2017 VA examiner, and we agree with appellant on this point, provided inadequate rationale as to two of the three identified in-service risk factors. So in this case, appellant has identified three in-service risk factors, which he asserts are the cause of his hepatitis C, specifically in-service dental work, high-risk sexual behavior, and exposure to jet gun injectors. First, as the issue of dental work, the examiner provided an adequate rationale here that the appellant's hepatitis C is less likely than not due to in-service dental work because there's no evidence of exposure to blood during a dental treatment or that appellant received a blood transfusion during service. So consistent with the examiner's rationale here, the appellant's service dental records do not document him being exposed to blood at any point during a dental treatment. And as opposing counsel has already noted, appellant has only asserted that he received a dental treatment using unsanitary dental treatment or dental tools and asked that VA make the logical leap that unsanitary or unclean tools resulted in exposure to blood. We would disagree that this logical leap is warranted in this case. In fact, the VA examiner specifically considered this issue, considered the service treatment records, and determined that it was less likely than not the cause of the veteran's hepatitis C.
So, Mr. Yu.
Judge Toth or Judge Valvey, you can fight it out.
Well, I'll go ahead then.
The Marine, so.
That's right. It sounds like you're saying with respect to the dental, the claim that the dental treatment, there's nothing further for the VA to do with that one.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So are you going to continue responding to Judge Toth's question then?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. In response to Judge Toth's question, the remaining two in-service risk factors, the September 2017 VA examiner provided inadequate rationale. And we agree with appellant on this point. And therefore, consistent with the court's prior holdings, remand for the board to obtain an adequate VA medical opinion that provides adequate rationale to in-service risk is warranted in this case. If there are no questions
for you, could I just follow up with one thing, and then I think Judge Toth has a question too.
Yes, I
just want to bring you back a little bit. When you and I were talking about the note in the M21 that
involved
reasonable doubt, and you said that applied in VA's view to just element two of service connection.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I managed to find it on my little screen here now. So I'm just wondering if the note actually is susceptible to that reading. Because what it says is resolve reasonable doubt under blah, blah, blah in favor of the veteran when the evidence, I have to minimize this here, when the evidence favoring risk factors in service is equal to the evidence favoring risk factors before service or after service. What I'm wondering is that would be sort of odd, right? Because it would say if there's evidence of a jet gun in injection, right? In service, and there's evidence of exposure to blood in service. Let's just assume that, right? But there's three risk factors from outside service. This would sort of say, oh, well, then there isn't an in-service event. But of course, there would still be an in-service event, right? It would be injection with the air jet injector. And so theoretically, you could have a medical opinion that would say, yes, that was the cause, right? And so isn't the more natural reading of the note to say that it really is a scale, that if you've got three risk factors in service and none outside of service, hypothetically, grant the claim. Don't just say there's an in-service event. Do you see?
I understand your question, Your Honor, but we would fundamentally disagree that this note would obviate the need to obtain a medical opinion on the issue of nexus. If you look through the grid, as you call it, it indicates that there are varying degrees of likelihood. So, for example, the jet gun injectors, it specifically specifies that there's never been a documented case in which exposure to jet gun injectors has resulted in a transmission of hepatitis C. It does note that it's theoretically possible. And because that it is theoretically possible, we would note that the M21 still directs VA adjudicators to obtain a nexus opinion. And we would also note that if you look at the M21 as it pertains to the sections regarding adjudicating claims for hepatitis, the remainder of the M21 makes clear that a VA examination for or VA medical opinion to determine nexus is needed. So we would disagree that the language here, which opposing counsel has already articulated, is written by non-attorneys for non-attorneys, that to the extent it inartfully articulates the point that or the position we are making, that it should not be read to require service connection if there are more in-service events or more in-service risk factors than there are non-service related.
Do we know how this is applied? In other words, do the frontline adjudicators do what you're suggesting, or do they really use this as a checklist? I mean, one of the advantages and disadvantages simultaneously of a checklist approach is if I need to do something and I just have to check off boxes, it's really easy to say I've checked 3 boxes in favor of the veteran and 2 boxes against the veteran. I'm putting them on the scale, to use Judge Falvey's point, than it is for the adjudicator to say, okay, I've got this, so I'm going to mix it into my beaker and then do some more hard lifting work. Do we know if the frontline adjudicators use it one way or the other?
I cannot provide, Your Honor, I can't provide you a definitive answer on this particular point. I would note that obviously in this case, the board felt the need, consistent with the N-21, or at least our position on the N-21, that a VA medical opinion was needed. We would also note that the appellant presented or submitted a board opinion that is not on appeal here, in which the veteran was granted service connection for hepatitis C as due to exposure to JECA and injectors. But in that case, the decision was based on 2 positive nexus opinions. So I can't provide you statistics on how the VA adjudicators, deal with this issue. But we would note that specifically in this case, the board obviously felt the need to obtain a VA medical opinion on the issue of nexus. And if there are no questions on my second point, then I'll move to the third point. Remand and not reversal is the proper remedy in this case. First, we would note that this court has previously held where the duty to assist has not been satisfied, that generally the proper proper remedy is to remand for further development. And as I articulated earlier, here the September 2017 VA examination.
Let me hop in.
Yes.
So as I understand, the duty to assist exists for the benefit of the veteran, right?
And correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Ridgway, the veteran's not asking for more assistance, right? More development. They're claiming that the record right now is sufficient to decide to claim. Does the duty to assist essentially cease after a board decision unless the veteran actually objects and requests more assistance? Do you understand my question?
Let me make sure I understand your question. Is your question that if appellant, as he appears to do so in this case, waives any duty to assist error,
So a case called Douglas from 2009 wrote this, which is the secretary has an affirmative duty to gather evidence to make an informed decision on a claim, even if that means gathering negative evidence, as long as it does so in an impartial, unbiased manner, right? So the secretary has an affirmative duty, right? But that duty exists for the benefit of the veteran. It's not a duty to oneself, right? And the point is, the board, this case has already been, there's 2 separate examinations, 7 years apart. The first examination was 10 years ago. The board has written a decision, right? What more development do we need? The veteran here is not requesting more development as a remedy, right? So it would have to be, VA would have to have, in a sense, some right or duty under statute just intrinsically to develop evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand your question now. In the court's prior holding in Barr v. Nicholson, the court held that where VA has provided a VA medical examination, even when it's not required to do so, it must provide an adequate examination or explain why an adequate examination cannot provide it. So we would say...
So relatedly, and I understand that, does the fact that 10 years have passed, does the time and the fact that this would be the third examination, does that have any bearing on a substantive right?
I mean, we would say that, you know, the veteran has the right for an examination or an adequate examination, and the time it takes, while regrettable, is not would not bear on that issue, if I understand your question correctly. Furthermore, the court has held that reversal is only warranted if the only permissible view of the evidence is contrary to the board's findings. And this is based on the clearly erroneous standard. And the court has previously described the clearly erroneous standard as the as such. To be clearly erroneous, a decision must strike us as more than maybe or probably wrong. It must strike us as wrong with the force of a five-week-old unrefrigerated dead fish.
Mr. Yu, first, you can take up to five additional minutes, by the way, because I granted that to Mr. Ridgway. But I have a question. If, just again, just assume that, because I want to try to put this into little boxes, right, make this easier for me. Just assume that we read the note to be the scale approach, okay, saying this is what you do. You check the boxes, okay? So assume that, and assume that under some theory, we find that that was the rubric that the board needed to apply. Okay, are you with me on both those?
Yes, Your Honor.
Under that scenario of the world, and I know this is not the world in which you think we should play, but just assume with me, under that scenario, reversal would be appropriate, right? Because you said there is no evidence of any pre or post service risk, and there is evidence of in-service, right? There's some evidence of in-service. So if the note were read as appellant suggests, then reversal would be appropriate. Do you agree with that?
We would disagree, Your Honor. And the reason being, while a particular non-service related risk factor or cause has not been identified, the two VA examiners opined that the veteran's hepatitis is not related to any service-related risk factor.
Well, so let me just, I'm not binding you in the sense that this is the way we're going to come out, because I don't know. Literally, I don't know. If we read this provision as saying the way we are going to grant service connection in hepatitis C cases is, we're going to say, we're going to check off risk factors, and evidence of in-service risk
Your Honor, I'm not hearing you anymore.
Yeah, Judge Allen, I can't hear you.
So we're going to, I guess, pause at this point. We're at the five-minute mark, basically.
So Judge Allen says he dropped his internet and he'll be back in about 2 minutes, so everyone can sit tight.
Sorry about that, everybody. I lost internet for a moment. So I have no idea where I stopped transmitting, Mr. Yu, but I don't know if you remembered the question. But the point being, if we read the provision that way to be a check the scale sort of approach, that in that scenario here, there would be reversal, right?
We would still disagree. And the reason being that the check box approach effectively creates a presumption. And we would disagree that, you know, because there are varying degrees of likelihood of a different risk factor causing a transmission of hepatitis C, that a presumption would be appropriate in any case.
Right.
And under the
interim. I do fully understand all of the secretary's positions. I'm just trying to get to the point that if, in fact, we read this in the way that I just said, and again, I'm not taking the position that that's the way it should be read, but that literally it is like Judge Falvey described, you put a risk factor on each side of the scale and you see which side the scale tips. If we said it works as simply as that, there's nothing to do on remand in terms of granting in that scenario, right? If that's the way we read this.
I mean, we would still disagree, I believe, because while the M21...
Let me state it this way. Assume that my articulation of the... And this is much like the comment I made to Mr. Ridgway, which is, right. I don't think you need to plant your feet on this point, but if you want to, that's fine. But then my question would be, okay, assume that we adopted the reading I have articulated, checkbox, scale, whichever metaphor you want.
Right.
Okay. We would then remand and we'd say, we remand to the board so you board can do what? Because the only thing that would matter in if you adopted the view that I articulated just a moment ago would be right. Go develop negative evidence, right? That would be the only possible thing that the board could do on remand, because we'd say this case has been pending for a long time. The scale has at least one risk factor in service, zero risk factors outside of service. The only development, if we read the provision as I said, okay,
right.
The only development would be to go look and see if you can find a risk factor out of service, right? But that would be inappropriate. That's what I'm just trying to say. In this very narrow scenario, remand or reversal would be the appropriate remedy. You've got tons of arguments about why, in fact, we shouldn't do that because the provision doesn't mean that. And I'm not addressing that. I'm just trying to get this very narrow point.
Yes, we would agree with your hypothetical or your scenario that you've just articulated, with a single caveat that the board would be required to identify a specific cause, as opposed where here the evidence just demonstrates or at least implies that the actual cause of the appellant's hepatitis C is something other than service. Now, we would agree that, you know, the board would be required to, you know, if the board is not required to identify the actual cause and actually state, you know, the actual cause is XYZ, you know, we would concede otherwise to that, concede your scenario other than that point.
Thank you.
To continue on, here at the very minimum, the September 2017 VA examiner provided some competent, credible, and probative evidence that weighs against nexus. And the court here should reject appellant's assertion that reversal is warranted if the evidence is at least as likely as not that his hepatitis C is due to service. Appellant is impermissibly attempting to apply the benefit of the doubt standard here at the court rather than the clearly erroneous standard, which actually applies here. Next, the court should reject appellant's algebraic theory of reversal because this is contrary to the governing statutes. Appellant's hypothetical in his opening brief demonstrates why this theory of reversal is contrary to the governing statute. Under his hypothetical, he asserts that he needs a 50% probability of certainty that his disability is related to service before the board under the benefit of the doubt standard, while after he has appealed the claim to the court, he needs only a 40% certainty that his disability is related to service before reversal is warranted. And under this hypothetical, he assumes that the court needs 80% certainty. I see my time has run out.
You can keep going, Mr. Yu. Don, could you put 5 minutes on the clock so that we can even out the time? Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. Under this theory of reversal, the appellant only needs a 40% certainty that reversal is warranted, and this assumes that the court needs an 80% certainty before it would grant reversal. If the court needed some lesser degree of certainty, then the appellant's burden would continue to fall. Now, this is in contrast to the governing statute under 38 U.S.C. 7261A4. A material finding of fact by the board can only be overturned if it is clearly erroneous, which this court has previously articulated is a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. This is in contrast to the benefit of the doubt standard, which applies to the board, which only requires that appellant demonstrate that the positive and negative evidence is in equipoise. And under appellant's hypothetical, it demonstrates that the algebraic theory of reversal would be warranted for even a lesser degree of certainty than the benefit of the doubt standard, which is in complete contrast to the clearly erroneous standard, which is more deferential to the board. Furthermore, reversal would only be warranted if appellant has demonstrated that the only permissible view of the evidence is contrary to the board's findings. And then finally, the court should reject appellant's comparative narrative theory of reversal because, again, this is contrary to the governing statute. Appellant asserts that reversal is warranted because he has presented three theories of entitlement based on the three in-service risk factors identified in this case, and because the board has not adequately or sufficiently rebutted his three theories of entitlement. Now, this position was expressly rejected by the Federal Circuit in Skozin versus Shinseki, which the Federal Circuit held that appellant has the burden of establishing all three elements of service connection before service connection would be warranted. Appellant's theory of reversal impermissibly shifts the burden to the board to reject or rebut his lay theories of entitlement rather than appellant having the burden to establish all the elements of service connection. The board would be permitted to deny service connection if appellant had presented insufficient, competent, credible, and probative evidence of nexus. But that's not the case here. At the very minimum, the September 2017 VA examiner provided a negative opinion that appellant's hepatitis C is less likely than not due to any in-service event, injury, or disease. The appellant has not demonstrated the only permissible view of the evidence is contrary to the board's finding that service connection is not warranted for lack of evidence of nexus, and therefore remand for a new VA medical opinion with adequate rationale consistent with the duty to assist is warranted in this case. If there are no other questions, then I'll conclude my presentation.
Judge Cho?
Nothing.
Judge Kaplan?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yu. Mr. Ridgway, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin by reminding what is the issue in this case. The issue in this case is not, did Mr. Andrews get hepatitis? He did get hepatitis. That's not in question. The question is, when did he get hepatitis? It may have been a low probability event that resulted in the transmission of the virus to him, but it happened. He lost the lottery, or however you want to look at it. The question before the board, the question before the court is, when did this event occur? All of the evidence suggests that this occurred in service. He's affirmatively denied risk factors that would have occurred post-service. VA has had him go through two medical examinations where his medical history was taken and the doctors reviewed his record. Neither of those examinations determined a post-service risk factor. The secretary has not identified in any way how medical expertise would be applied to the specific facts of his case to conclude that this is not one where the evidence of in-service risk factors outweighs the absence of any evidence of post-service risk factors. What the secretary asked for is a remand under for a new examination, and the secretary invokes section H2J of the M21, a different part of it. And you know, I would note in particular that the way it describes to the adjudicators to procure an examination for hepatitis says, number step six, notify the examiner that a positive nexus opinion, if warranted, should take only confirmed risk factors as shown by the objective evidence of record into consideration. It explicitly tells the adjudicators to instruct examiners to violate Buchanan, to ignore anything that is not objectively proven by evidence in the record. These hepatitis cases are not about whether or not there's objective evidence in the record. We're past that with Buchanan and Jandro and Davidson. If something was within the competence of a lay person to observe, then that has to be considered and that has to be weighed. And if there is nothing else to weigh against it, then the claim should be granted. Therefore, a remand would serve no other purpose but to delay this. Now, I do want to acknowledge, as Judge Toth said, this is a low evidence case. A great deal of these hepatitis cases are low evidence cases because it takes so very long for the virus to result in the damage that ultimately gets compensated. And so the secretary is just fundamentally incorrect to say that you need to have a definite and firm conviction in the merits of Mr. Andrews' case. As we cited Concrete Pipes, the question before the court is, do you have a definite and firm conviction that the evidence rises to the standard below that the adjudicator was required to consider? Has this reached the benefit of the doubt standard? And let's turn to 3.102, which we quoted in our brief, the benefit of the doubt regulation. The benefit of the doubt regulation says that it exists where an approximate balance of positive and negative evidence exists, which does not satisfactorily prove or disprove the claim. This is a situation where, you know, much to our frustration, the evidence does not satisfactorily prove or disprove the claim. And in this, under that situation, the benefit of the doubt applies. You grant the claim if it's within...
Sorry to slow your roll here, but let me, I want to kind of push on what the difference is maybe here between like clear error and just a kind of a disagreement about weighing evidence, right? Because the sense I'm getting, what I'm hearing is clear error is sort of maybe a matter of degree and not kind, right? Which is, I may vehemently disagree with how the board weighed the evidence, but that might just be a disagreement. If I can cite to no sort of error of commission, right, something they did wrong or something they didn't do that they were supposed to do, right? Meaning a clear error can be a small error. It is just an easy, cognizable legal error, right? Whereas a disagreement might be somewhat vast disagreement, but nothing, I can't point to anything that amounts to a cognizable error. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, and I would disagree with that formulation. So as the Supreme Court said in Concrete Pipes, the clear error standard, like any error, the standard of review, is about your level of certainty that the fact finder in the first instance made a mistake when applying the appropriate burden to the evidence. You're acting as the fact finder in the second evidence, as the Federal Circuit has described, as the final arbiter of the facts.
Well, I mean, and again, sorry to jump in, but I mean, one way we refine the clear error is to say that if something lacks a plausible basis in the record, right, that's clear error, right? So something can have a plausible basis, but I, as a, you know, if I were the fact finder in the first instance, may have completely read it differently. But I, you know, as a reviewing judge, I can't say it lacks a plausible basis in the record, right? Is your argument here that what the board found just simply had no basis in the record? I mean, is that how I understand it? Or is it something different?
So yes, our argument here is that there is no basis in the record for what the board did. And there has been no identified reason why additional development is appropriate. But I think if you turn to the Federal Circuit cases that we cite in our reply brief, and you see how they conduct clear error review in case after case after case. They look at the evidence themselves, and when they have a definite and firm conviction that the fact finder below did not weigh the evidence properly, they reverse and award the appropriate outcome.
Let me ask you this, because I want to ask about additional development, right? Because obviously, you know, both parties have agreed that there was an error with the examination. The usual remedy for an inadequate examination is a new examination. I have two law professors on the panel here, but so my question is a bit theoretical, but I want to kind of go there, which is like in a civil case or a criminal case, right, where jurors exist and they're the fact finders, is really, you know, it, with rare exceptions, a appellate court will never sort of send a case back for further development, right? But obviously, you know, in the veteran system, the development sort of can continue beyond through the appellate process, right? And so I'm asking you, I want to get a point, and I ask Mr. Yu this, is there a point where, in a sense, VA's right to develop a case ceases, right? That after a board decision, it no longer can sort of just continue to add additional development, or, I mean, as you argue, I guess, that can only be to deny a claim, right? Is there a way that we can tell the difference?
Yes, and it's good to go back to McClendon. This is about the often forgotten step four of McClendon. McClendon step four says you do the development where it's indicated, and then step four says, and there already isn't sufficient evidence to resolve the claim. And so here, because the appellant is asking for reversal, what we're saying is, yes, that duty to assist error occurred, and we would have a right to a remand, which we articulate in the alternative. But when we look at step four of the McClendon analysis and we invoke Adams, the evidence is sufficient to grant the claim. And therefore, we do not need the lesser remedy. I think when you think about it that way, you understand why remand is very frequently the remedy when the person does not ask for a reversal and isn't arguing that the evidence already is sufficient to grant the claim. But this is an argument under Adams v. Principi where we have a right to reversal right now without remand, even though there's a duty to assist violation, because the evidence is already sufficient and the court must address the sufficiency of the evidence before it can fall back to the question of whether or not further evidence is required. And I think the problem, to shift slightly to one of the other, the problem is the metaphors that we use. We keep talking about different metaphors, whether it's dead fish or trying to observe a play at first base or scales or things that are not actually how we consider the evidence. And that's where I think the work of Allen and Pardo come in, where they say that what actually happens is when the best explanation of the evidence and the events in dispute is that the fact in dispute happened, then the preponderance is in favor of concluding that's what happened. And, you know, if something is a simpler explanation, if it covers more of the evidence, if it requires fewer ad hoc presumptions about stuff not proven, that's when we actually say the preponderance of the evidence applies. And if you look at that, you have a definite and firm conviction that the simpler, most comprehensive explanation is the one that favors granting benefits, then the claim should be reversed and benefits should be granted. I see that I am out of time, but I'm happy to answer more questions or to conclude quickly.
Judge Tote, do you have any further questions?
I don't, thanks.
Judge Falvey?
I don't, thank you.
Why don't you just take 30 seconds or so to wrap up, Mr. Ridgway?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Andrews has been fighting this claim for over 10 years. He survived a liver transplant. He survived a kidney transplant. But there is no reason why he should be asked to survive another turn on the hamster wheel at the board, especially when the development rules have no applicability to his case. Every day, four veterans die at the board without ever getting an answer. Mr. Andrews should not be forced to take the risk that he'll be one of those. The time is to end this claim and to simply award service connection for hepatitis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ridgway. Thank you, Mr. Yu. We appreciate the party's arguments this morning, as well as your briefing in the case, and the matter is submitted.
The court is in recess.